Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... This is a podcast so technically difficult, it actually makes my head hurt. And the objective of this podcast is to, at the end of it, ask you to fill in a form, which is in the blog, and having filled in the form, you will generate a podcast quiz. And it's technically difficult because there's sort of five... It's a complex thing to ask you to do, because normally there's an expectation that you'll talk around and you listen if you want to, or I've asked you to listen or understand, but this is actually going one step outside the podcast space where I'm actually aiming to get you to do things. Now, realistically, I expect, things already begin to happen, but say 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10, that'll be enough to make a big difference. However, there's this, a few golden rules which are going to be broken here. One is that I'm going to go through, I've ticked over my head, 5 complex phases in explaining it to you, and you may not understand every phase. You may get a few gist of a few things, but if you do fill in the podcast, sorry, the form, it's a Google form at the end, it's a fairly safe thing to do, it will all begin to make sense. So it's normally the way you progress is that you don't leave things hanging where people are scratching their heads or don't know what to do. You try and sort of make podcasts where at least you think you're making sense and you go across. And so in advance is this understanding that, oh, perhaps it's going to be high risk. I'm not going to get everyone in the process. And I'm sort of breaking certain basic rules because I'm going to mix a whole lot of concepts up to try and get you across the line. Now, why this change? Well, again, I'm going to use an analogy. Occasionally, you see something, a change in behavior. Well, let's put it like this: in an intelligence scenario, you've got a population. And you're watching the population, watching the intelligence picture, and you'll notice that there will be one small thing that people start to get their water from a local creek, or people are stocking up on food, and you know that this has actually changed the psychology and the change is afoot. And your objective is to get on top of this and to actually... do it. In the commercial world, for me, it's occasionally like the first time, you know, those little scooters, I saw someone pass on the scooters and I said, this is the little two-wheeled skateboard wheels, but those little push scooters. I saw someone the first time and I thought, oh, well, that's changed it. And the world has changed a bit. Or you'll see someone tap a card to pay for something. For the very first time, you say, oh, well, that's it may be the first time years before you see it, other people do it. You'll say, well, that's changed it. That's conditions. And when you're thinking, you can be, a lot of people think here and now, ignore it and stuff like that. But you can think strategically. And what's happened is that I've had the first couple of people come in with filling in the forms, loading up with quizzes, and it's changed. It's no longer me producing the content. It's me. Well, I'm not creating the content. I'm now producing it, and there's going to be this migration where I hope the whole thing takes off. I haven't really quite explained it well, and that I'll keep on doing it. So, just to give you a chart of where we're going, we're going to. I rather dislike this, but explain some of the higher theory with reference to military history, and I'll sort of explain why military history. Then we'll go into, because it's really important to do it, or it's because the way it exists, I'll go along with hopefully a bit of advanced theory about software and software design. Then I'll go into sort of the, very quickly, the practical state where I'm at too, where I've got to make a few practical decisions. This is where you'd expect to say that your average dude on a computer to go ahead. And then finally we're going to go back into a sort of fantasy world where I describe a World War One crisis situation meets the evolution, sudden eruption of a Star Wars scenario. And this is what really it is. We are living in a World War One. Well, I'm living in a World War One style, over the top, massive casualties and everything like that. And there's this sort of fantasy story about how, little by little you can put together normal things and make lightsabers and X-wing fighters and start to zoom around information space in a different vehicle. So really this, form that which will be there, there'll be a form and there'll be a synthetic quiz that the form will generate. So you've got the two, input this, output that. Okay, this is the fundamental proposition. That's sort of a little phase in the story of that scenario. I've really struggled. I have pools of experience that I can go on. I can have personal experience, social experience out here in Australia. There's the strategy, the classic business strategy and stuff like that. And there's sort of military history. I scratch my head. Why would military history be a better way to describe what's going on? Well, essentially, the fundamental core of business strategies or business stories is the successful business of making money and retaining value into your domain. And this is not quite what it is. It is a social change that we're after, a projection of, we'll mention this later, a projection of power. You want to change behavior and get engaged in certain ways, and then the businesses will flow afterwards. Now, there's a story, there is actually business literature associated with that, and I think it's called Across the Chasm, a sort of a 1990s book. There are theories about how this early stuff, the startup, is not necessarily about making money. It's about changing behaviours or strategic change. However, unfortunately, the war stories that I am going to mention deal very much with this area where it's a behaviour change that we're afterwards and a strategic change of thinking. Here's a behaviour change. Rather than just listening to a podcast, I'll be asking you to fill in a form, and it's up to me to try and produce it. I'm already a bit snowed under with the number of forms filled in. At this stage, before I launch in, it's just to mention a few people who I'll be sending it to. And now, one of the things before I go too far, with internet, with digital assets, you don't have to deploy them synchronously. So I will send this out to a few people, get the feedback, and if it keeps on going, I'll roll it out to more. So a couple of things, people, I think is Professor, I'll use the first name and the people know what the second is. Now I'm just breathing up here because I have to mix everything together in an overall strategic package. So I've got to do cardiac rehab, and so I'm going up a hill while I'm speaking out. Unfortunately, all of Glenbrook is asleep. So it's just a list of a few people. There's Professor Kate. There's Sylvia Amanda, who I'd like to have a look at that. There's Michael and Catherine and Andrew, to list through, list a few. There's Simon and John, who, if you can listen to this, you can do it yourself. Or what I'm really aiming for with these people is to have a go at yourself and then expand, sort of like a pyramid system. Go in your network and find, so that's a general network. I may have, I don't know, 30% produce one and 10% produce one and tell another person. And even though that seems low odds, that 10% of one will actually eventually exponentially grow. And of course, all my friends out there in podcast land, unfortunately in my memory, this is going to be a few, an old friend in the UK. I can't remember your name. All I'm going to say is the word elephant, and you'll be able to put it together. Okay, so there are these economics or business texts, but we're in a sort of coming at things from an R&D behavior change. We want to move things over. Now, one of the things, if you can't understand where it's coming from, let's tell you about the fundamental business proposition. The fundamental thing why it works, and this is really the second segment I want to go to, but the fundamental thing is that I can spend an hour preparing a lesson. Traditionally, what's happening now is that in that hour, the lesson preparation can be a bit more focused and structured, and then that lesson preparation there then goes into a system of a trailer, a fun, hopefully a fun podcast. That real people go, oh, she was, I should mention before I go too far, is Kim, Kim and Richard, but Kim in particular, if I can get you to look in on the music, listen to what's going on, and fix the music. So, getting back to, so I produce this, fill in this form, put it into the communal system, it gets produced into a radio into a system of programs. The students can challenge themselves, they can listen to the class, and another way they can do private study. But it doesn't stop there. The actual quality is going up and up and optimized, so it will be much higher quality than could be produced individually. It can be focused. There's also optimization for presentation and class using educational psychology to do with the layout of a forms of class such that people can see confidence building. Then on top of that, there's structures which go in which will essentially allow people to build better high quality lessons. But furthermore, the critical aspect of it is the ability to copyright your question. You write a question, it's copyright yours, and we can actually control the copyright of a question as it's moved into, as it moves to different different locations. However, that question can be improved. So, as it is, a very much bastardized version of the question eventually gets into a textbook, and it has a life of its own which lasts, well, sometimes hundreds of years, where it goes through, and it can resist change. Now, your question, unfortunately, won't resist change. People will be able to challenge it and improve it. And so this is a sort of different quality paradigm, which is at the heart. Like the poor quality paradigm is at the heart there. Now, I come across, I'm going to be drowned out by a passing train, because I'm walking in Glenbrook along there. So that's that. But as promised, I'm going to mention the military paradigm. So I read a lot of philosophy, I've done an MBA, a lot of business stuff, a lot of maths, some quantum physics, obviously, But I also do read, I suppose, army journals and army and military history, just because that's really there reflects one aspect of society where the people, there are bad guys out there, or there's structures which haven't got your interest at their very heart. Okay, that might be the fundamental reality of a war, is that it's a situation where another group of people don't have your best interest in their heart. They'll tell you differently. So here comes, unfortunately, a train going past. It's a suburban train, so it's not going to be too loud. Okay, so now, unfortunately, when talking about war things, people, there's a bit of sensitivity about it, and there's inevitably in an international audience, you're going to be talking about the wrong side. So I'm going to mention one German person, and a lot of people are going to dislike it. Then I'll stick to a safe, an Australian general. And the reason I want to talk about this is the concept of projection of strategic force. That may be, I do actually mean that. And technology coming forward. And so the first person I want to mention is, and I forget it, I've only read it and we pronounce it incorrectly, Guderian. Guderian? I can't pronounce him properly. But he wrote a book. He obviously did a lot in World War II and stuff like that. But he wrote a book called, what was it? Achtung Panzer, which means, I suppose, stop tank, which is obviously strange, isn't it? You mean you want to say go tank or something, but this, oh, stop, the tanks are coming. Something, I don't quite understand. It sounds quite German, doesn't it? But what about, what's this? This is a slim volume, and some of it is complete madness. It's World War II madness. You know, some nations are born to become mechanized, blah, 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 that type of stuff. But on this, he sets out the idea of focusing not just on sort of understanding what the mechanism can do, motorization can do. So in this case, your form will be motorized to go through. He talked, obviously, with motorcycles and stuff like that. You make your troops highly mobile. And let's just think what this means. And basically, you need mechanized supply, communication, and command. Obviously, you took a lot longer to say that. But essentially, that's what he said. And he sort of laid down I don't know. There you go. I can't believe car can make that much noise. Okay, that was the car going past. He laid down what we call the doctrine, and I'm sure there's other people who've laid down the doctrine of just basically saying, oh well, if I write a program, what can it do? What support does it need? What's the actual society around it? So, and this is important because you put it forward and you do lots and lots of planning to supply links into that program and integrate it so it works together and brings across. And so the critical threshold link is just a simple Google Docs, which takes the format to put into this automated projection. And similar to command and control, which will move along with it, the question secretes quality information and can be quality improved. Unlike your standard sort of foot soldier textbook, these are mechanized and can go through. Now that hasn't been done yet, but the architecture is there already rolling out to pick apart the audio questions and integrate it and move across. So now, this is, I suppose, it's probably another area touched upon by this author, is the mentality. So if you don't have the mentality to understand mechanization, it's just not going to work quite as good, as well for you. So in this case, I suppose I have, having read that, I've read the mentality to go forward. So there's that. Now I'll move on to safer ground, and this is probably a person you've never heard of, and that's General Leslie Morshead. So I think he started off in World War One, or he definitely started off in World War One, and due to complete lunacy, the Australians invaded. Okay, Australians invaded Turkey. Okay, so there was an equal number of French who invaded, but rather than use, I think there was some British troops, there was Australian and New Zealand people invaded Turkey, and I don't know, the sort of war lunacy, not lunacy, took over Australia, but a good over half of all able-bodied people left Australia, went overseas. I think it was a population of 4,300,000 Australians were involved in the war, and I think casualties were pretty high, 60,000 something. I should know these outright. This is the Bosporus up around sort of the Black Sea. And there's a whole lot of complex geopolitics about Russia and the Turkish Empire, which was supposed to just fold over. And so, like a discrete, it sort of makes sense in the big political thing that if you could knock Turkey out, you could, I don't know, but the Germans came in and trained the Turkish and actually over-controlled the Turkish army, so we sort of came up against a different army that was required. But you've got to imagine, these British had heaps and heaps of ships, and they had ships in the Bosphorus, the strait near up from Istanbul, and and I have to do mention the ships because these are important, and this Major Leslie Morshead was on the ground, and there are a whole lot of stories about his role in Gallipoli. So Gallipoli is this, I think it was 1915. So yeah, it's sort of there. So this is a failed campaign. The Australians stayed for 8 months, lost a huge number of troops, but nothing compared to what we're going to lose later on, a few months later in the Somme. And I swear, sure, I'll have to bring this up. And the story I want to do say is that he was going along and he saw this Australian soldier there, not sticking his head over the trench, but had his rifle up there and had arranged an elaborate arrangements of mirrors to form a periscope, and he was able to fire quite effectively. Now, it turns out that he was a gifted soldier on many things, so he knew how to build it himself and was able to do it. And so all of a sudden, there was rifle fire without the casualties. And so what he did was he analysed it, went back and stripped all the British ships of their mirrors, and cut up the mirrors, and this was a fairly standard kit for this couple of months or so in the campaign. And there was other sort of basic innovations going across. I should also mention that the water little tanks for distributing water were by this Australian company called Furphy, and you'd go up to the water tanks, fill up your water bottles, and you would chat there. And to this day, in Australia, we say if something's an unreliable piece of information you heard in the background and it's probably not true, we would say that's probably a Furphy. So that's how it got in. So what essentially happened is that the Australians were being paid by Australia and were being paid higher wages than the British troops, which meant that they turned out to be the elite troops of the British Empire. So the British Army had elite people of upper class, and the Grenadiers and the Queen's Own and the Scottish something or other, and the rest. But the Australians could be, I suppose, were put into battle, made a bit of complaint, taken back and retrained for trench warfare. So that sort of really changed a lot of what's going on, and essentially there'd be a very much difference when the Australians were training. And there is a story about training, and there is a story relevant to you in that once you learn how to fill in the questionnaire and fill in and get a positive response, your sort of job is to train the next person. Okay, so I don't know whether 10, I can only get 1 in 10 and 1 in 100, but if that 1 in 100 trains another person who trains another 2 or 3, and it gets going, and they work out how to train people to do it and explain it in their own terms rather than this really complex way which goes up to World War One, you can go there. And this is going to make people overseas vomit, but it probably won't. It probably won't make the French vomit, at least. There was this high land with Villers-Brittigny, and there will be to and fro against the Germans and the Australians, and it's when the Australians went into the village. It was this rather distressed person, because the British moved out and the Australians moved in, and it says, and this Australian soldier famously said, "No worries, Madame, il est beaucoup de Australians," and that was sort of, it's been I think it's still known in that that village, that training aspect. And so I want to, that sounds sort of pretty silly, but this our major, I think he got promoted a few times, Leslie Moorhead, went back to Australia. Now, a lot of critical things is that the Australian officers were reserve, before they went into the war, were reserve officers, and some of them were actually German. So a lot of the, this is strange, so Australia's most highly decorated or most effective general was also a first generation German. He sort of changed his name to a more English spelling of Monash, which is rather funny. So we have the Monash story. But we're looking at this unknown. He's unknown. He's sort of known in Australia in a little bit. So if you really dug in the War Museum, and you'd find out a bit about him. Or there's, I think, one little odd monument to this guy in the top of the Botanical Gardens. But no one would know what this particular guy did. So he went back, and I think he was a school teacher. In fact, yeah, a lot of them are school teachers. And he organised cadets at Geelong College. I'm going off. I wasn't planning to give this talk. Then World War II happened. You know, that's a lot of history. World War II happened. And there was a threat from the Italians coming down to Cairo. So they put some British Army regiments and two Australian regiments in North Africa. And Rommel came up to, I think it would have been Brindisi or something, somewhere up around Libya. I think Tripoli is also in Libya. But what happened was that when he landed and he organized as many tanks that arrived, he organized wooden tanks to be made, and they would stop the Spitfires coming in, but the Messerschmitts wouldn't catch them, and they'd come in and photograph them. And what happened is that he'd deployed all his army in the Northern Desert. This is all true, okay? People don't necessarily know, and very few people know this actual episode of World War II history. And now, in the meantime, the British really didn't pay too much attention to the Australians, and under Leslie Moorhead, he had three principles of preparation, and they were this: train, train, train. That's all he did. And so he trained the Australians in desert navigation, night navigation, night patrols, and fighting patrols. He rearranged the sort of concept of war and reconnaissance patrols. He sort of changed the actual structure of things. Now, the Germans suddenly appeared and the British were in confusion. They all fell back and they said, we want you to hold on to Tobruk. I think it was for 6 days or 6 weeks, something very short amount of time. Two Australian regiments, they said, and then the British gave one artillery unit to the Australians. And so Rommel came up with the Stukas and the tanks, and so far the German army had not been stopped in either the Eastern Front or Western Front, and they came up against the Australians to take Tobruk. And what happened is that they came up, bam, bang, 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 nothing happened, there was nothing. And so they came up really close, and when the tanks were at point blank range, within the range of the British artillery, they knocked out the tanks and pushed back the German infantry for the first time in World War II. Now, this is an Australian story, and this is what, I haven't been told this, I've just read it, and I've looked at the timelines, and said, oh, this is the first thing, an important thing. But the most important aspect of this, that the Germans retreated, and then they retreated, and to their shock and horror, they were attacked with night ambushes and patrols. And and this is what I'm talking about, the projection of strategic power. So the Germans tried to come back in, and what they do is they'd sight a trench, fire on it, get some fire back, and then next day they'd come over with trained artillery, this is 88s and stuff like that, to just blow apart the trench. Of course, the Australians had moved out and built another trench, and every time the Germans made a contact with the trench, they would get in there, and they were called the rats of the Tobruk. And they held there and projected strategic force, that is not necessarily what we're talking about, artillery or anything like that, but this is a psychological force. And the Germans basically organised their campaign not to take Tobruk. And when the Japanese came down and landed in New Guinea, the Australians said, well, we're leaving the desert, we're coming home to do it. And within a couple of months, I think it was an Indian and South African units came in, and Roll took them very, very, very quickly. And they came back. Now, this projection of strategic force, it was very much, if you read the Japanese invasion, is very much the upper hand coming down. But it is noteworthy that the reserve militia units, so Australia had nothing against the Japanese, and so the Japanese were coming down over, what was it, they were bombing the bejesus out of our northern cities, but they were going down, and they diverted ships, which was full of basically civilian soldiers, sort of militia soldiers, so people with no training. They may have had a weekend, and they were thrown up against the Japanese, and one shame of one, which is happens to be there were two regiments there. One was the Penrith Regiment, which is where I'm at the moment, which is the one that cracked and folded and ran away from the Japanese when the Japanese were about to pinch them up, and then there was the Hawthorn Regiment, which is just a suburb, just what was a bit rural back in World War II, but sort of central Melbourne. So it's the Melbourne and Sydney people, and they went up there. Significantly, the Japanese torpedoed the hospital ship that went up there, so they lost all the women's support. So it's a bit of a scary situation. But by the time they had fought the Japanese all the way back, or the Japanese came all the way up to Port Moresby, which is sort of like like I could see the sea. And stuff like that. By the time they came back, there was the concept of strategic projection, and they'd sort of worked out how to fight the Japanese, but it was very much an idea of outthinking them, and I know this sounds awful, and was it Groner? These are all very small battles. People have hardly heard of it. But if you read it, it's interesting about strategic projection. And so it's similarly here. The idea is we've got a new technology, a new game in town, and the traditional flow is changing. And this is really what I want to talk about. And it's something much easier to talk on a military basis. But I do want to mention something which really dramatically changed World War II. And it really had nothing to do with who was the better fighter and who believed what. And this was the proximity radar-guided anti-aircraft thing. So what happened is that the Germans made the V1 buzz bomb, which is sort of like basically a cruise missile. It was launched with peroxide and steam, the way that we launch missiles together. It's a pretty amazing process, and they were super fast. They were basically a jet engine, a pulse jet engine at the top, and the British had really nothing against them. The planes couldn't really be fast enough to get them. They eventually got jet planes to go up. And so, and they were causing Britain a much bigger headache. The V2s, which is the rockets, they just fed back, ranging information to the Germans, and they all overshot London. So, and they didn't cause as much damage as a V1, which had a psychological thing. You could hear it. I think it was something rather alley, you could hear them go across, and they would, the V1 had a smaller explosive, but would land at velocity into a block and just destroy the whole block. So it was something to be dealt with. And so the British accelerated radar proximity shells, and they couldn't produce it, so they went to the United States saying, can you help us out? And the United States then put their full industry on, and so this technology is equal important to the Manhattan Project. And then the Americans just completely armed up all their Pacific fleet with with these proximity shells, and I think it was called the turkey shoot. And in one operation, they suddenly had these shells, and they just really expended all of them. They had none left, but they had shot down basically the entire Japanese Air Force. Now, the Japanese planes were not designed. They were designed to be light, nimble, aggressive, for a different prediction of power. And this meant a technological thing. And so basically, the shell would blow up at the correct range. So it increased the efficiency of the shells by a factor of 10. So you didn't have to fire as many, and they just basically all blew up. And the Japanese aircrafts, they didn't have aircraft or their aircraft carriers anymore, so they were using their aircraft carriers to bait the Americans. And there's a whole heap of stories there, but this also begets the stories that you can get very bunkered down in the who did what and why, and you have one success in one area and training one area. But training is one part of the story. Development and putting foot through the technology is another part. And I honestly can't think of if I could have thought of a business case. So that's the first step of this multi-step tour. And you don't necessarily have to understand all the pieces of it. You have to sort of understand your role, a role in the production of all of this. So the next reason I want to describe, I can't really do very well. Suffice it to say that there are these sort of mathematical tricks or software things that you can put together, like little engines to produce podcasts or to restructure podcasts, and you've got to put them together, and then you've got to imagine the steps and break it apart and minimize the hurdle, the entry hurdle. So the minimum entry hurdle here has been minimized down. So that's a way to look at it. So this is internal strategy fitting out and introducing I'll produce it, but hopefully I'll be able to train up other people to produce the audio stuff. And there is sort of new technology, in train. Once it's up and running, new things can just replace it. That's the internal, sort of the internal strategy focus, as opposed to the external strategy focus, is where you're effectively blocked. You want to go forward, but you would need resources of training, access to students, resources to go ahead traditionally. And although things may seem advantageous traditionally, it's not necessarily the best way to go in terms of the actual blocking off a strategic part. So ideally, you'd be wanted to make a proposition to the powers that be in the education thing, convince them, carry them with you, have the self-aware to actually have that charm where you dress properly and you got that wink, and you mention their football team, and you mention their cat and the garbage, whatever it is. Whatever people do who are very successful at this, they're very successful, but they're not necessarily got the internal strategy. They've got the external strategy. And on the external strategy front, you can be blocked. But what that means is that the internal strategy, you can just keep on chonk, piece next to piece. That piece will work for the moment, but we'll replace it down the track with another thing. So therefore, when I'm designing it, I'll design it to be upgraded. Now, I'm not supremely successful in that. In that, there is some some legacy structures which are sort of crawling up and down this thing. I just have to accept it. I can't really explain that, but the file naming stuff is a legacy structure, and I've got to build in and build out. Of course, it takes no time on a computer as well. But there's sort of other things about, like I'm building one computer. I'd like to, so I'm building it such that this can be a cluster of computers. And so if something goes down and jams the computer, it knows that the information sent there has jammed it. It then raises up other computers in the network, which doesn't take that type of information. So you have to keep on striking every computer in your cluster with a different type of mistake. I know that sounds a bit hard to understand, but I'm sort of designing that that in advance. If you can see this process as a whiteboard with different things, it's looking at sort of the minimum steps to get multiple people in at different stages. And this is where it goes. The concept is strategic projection of force. It's a very much different proposition if a single person is producing the whole block and tackle, because you can just close the door, right? You can say, oh, he's wearing the wrong type of clothes. So-and-so says it's not good. But if you can get, and this is why I'm throwing it open to overseas, if I can get, you know, one or two overseas people going, and sort of the network going up in Australia, producing at this level, I can get sufficient feed in to get the next levels going up, so that's people who can actually speak and produce it. Then the computers can, it's just a matter of having computers, they'll just go over. It's probably a day or so's work to refit the programs that are more mobile phone formats that can be picked up and transferred from computer to computer and get it going across, so it can actually do that. And that obviously has a greater throughput, but it also projects strategic strength or zone of influence, similar to the different strategies in the Northern Desert. Australians didn't have very particularly powerful weapons or guns. They were completely outgunned by the Germans, but the actual tactics and strategies meant that it changed the psychology. So that's at that level, at the very high level. Now in the so that's the second level. This is the next level, which is just the practicality of producing the software. There's probably not much to say there, but being able to throw in Google Docs, which is fairly safe. You know, Google Docs is Google Forms. You can fill in a Google form. That's a pretty safe thing to do, and it's got the advantage that it's hermetically sealed. You put in a Google Doc, you're safe from everything Google, and magically, what you write in a Google Doc will be produced. I suppose getting back strategically, as I think I've got the first one I have to do is about Soviet weaponry. I have to do a quiz about that. So that's seriously different. But it's the critiques going back. Sort of, it's now not a critique to me. It's a critique to another person about, you know, you didn't explain that very well. You know, it's sort of, it moves it on. So there's these structures, and in general, the editing process is a sit down one go. So it's a synchronous editing process. Oh, it's not quite But you've got to follow a recipe. You can't jump around and go back and forth, whereas this is really an array editing process. I just don't have the software bits and pieces. It requires skill. This is the sound bit, so that's what I'm going to have to push ahead. I can't really describe. It isn't important for me, but it's not necessarily important for the overall view. I have to, for myself, what it means is that I've got to do so much production, so much critical software migration, and at this stage I have to work out, you know, what's going to give the biggest bang for the buck, not in so much in time, but in handing over. So if I have to hand over production to people, what to do. Now, as promised, the final area, which is the a sort of a fantasy psychological allegory. So this is, just before I go too far, this internal-external strategy is sort of one of the key dimensions of strategy training, business strategy training. So there's Omai, the mind of the strategist, which is a Japanese strategist, which talks about strategic scenario. And what I've been building up there is a view of your potential role, not as a listener, but as a participant in a strategic scenario. So that's straight from Japanese strategy, Omai, the mind of strategists, but also the internal external strategies from the SWOT analysis. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. Strengths and the weaknesses are your internal strategies, opportunities and threats are the external strategies. And trying to work out what you're managing. And so obviously you don't talk to customers about your internal strategy, but you've got to make the internal strategy really part of your own company. And so what often happens is that you're dealing with a whole lot of situations, and at the end of the day you say, why am I doing that? Well, the internal strategies have become so close, they've spilled over to how people conduct themselves and opportunities. They do that so they will close off an opportunity so that you have to pay them more to go forward. And if you don't do that, they've got no option but to ratchet up the stuff. So what I would like to do is, for the final and closing pitch, I'm going to see if I can summarise the game at the end of this, so we're not quite finished, is this World War One fantasy thing. There's no particular enemy, but the, you know, people are going over the top. There's a problem of morale, mutiny, and you've got someone who is not listening completely to and not believing and not living the entire story that you're giving. This is in the World War One situation, and you can suspect it, and you really basically have to teach people about the mechanism of internal strategy. So you can't just make threats and say, you have to actually carry them out, and you have to tie people up with dealing with internal strategy, thinking about internal strategy, and essentially imprison people and sort of threaten a firing squad at the end of the day, and try and set up a process which the person who's thinking strategically has to divide their time up, a sufficient time to buy time to slow this process up, and in the meantime to actually start constructing strategic machinery and strategies that will operate beyond a internally focused, stagnant way of doing things. And so essentially you will design, and say you can design it, a lightsaber, and you set aside land and resources eventually to build X-Wing fighters at the back. Now, you know what X-Wing fighters are because you've watched Star Wars and you know what can happen. But of course, people in the trenches who are very much beaten up and promoted if they can actually, you know, commissar everything in position, don't. And so it's very much the putting together the lightsabers and using the force to actually get the lightsaber to start to rattle around in the trenches, and people pick it up and feel the force going on. And idea is that when one person picks up one lightsaber, you can produce more, manufacture it through this miraculous new technology of internet and putting things across, and very soon things can eventually go. And if things are planned ahead, so people can sort of sense the force and lightsabers, wow, that's great, across like that. But of course, unfortunately, I'm sure people can be laughing about the Death Star and things like that, but you can get up and going. Now, the thing is that external strategy is not focused on winning the internal strategy war. That's been going nowhere for hundreds of years. We're interested in the strategic thing of teaching quantum mechanics and innovation and problem solving. Innovation, problem solving, quantum theory, advanced mathematics. I've got a few things that we're interested in, and we're interested in building the X-Wings and launching people off. And the thing that which appears as looming large as the drum roll of the, we've selected the firing squad, all line up. Oh, we've had an interdiction here. Oh, it's not going quite well. Oh, no one's interested in watching that plot. The history is over. We're emerging to a new regime. Now, for people listening, you'll say, well, absolutely stark raving mad. However, there are little glimmers of the new technology coming in. One is able to produce these quizzes. That should sort of, that's a bit odd. Being able to produce a quiz, two or three quizzes a day, and hopefully if I can get the software out and the people doing it, hey, that's not a business. Well, no, because the business model isn't going to work in Australia. There's simply not the market, not the money coming through, not the time period that we can deploy, because everyone's got a personal computer, everyone's got the basics to just really switch this on right across the world. So that's the aim of looking at your strategic palette. So really, I've got basically it's technology strategy, what works with the technology strategy. Given that these blocks are here, what can you do? It would be very lovely if we could make a heap of money out of it. Something like that. That's not on the orders list in the World War I world. So I think this podcast is actually will probably sound mad to a majority of people, but at least it's got through a story of World War I. Hopefully you've gotten to the World War I story. Then you listen to this slightly odd strategy thing, and then you've got the thing is, yeah, I'm just trying to bring some Star Wars into the World War One scenario, and but sort of not engage in pointless, unproductive behaviour. We're about productive behaviour. We're the good guys. We're going to get them. So that being said, in summary, in this podcast, you will have a link to a a classroom page for a quiz. It won't be. Well, it'll be hopefully a good one. And then you'll have a link to a quiz, and you yourself mightn't want to do one. I don't care. You can put rubbish. I'm not going to. If you do an offensive one, either I'm stupid, I'll put it through. I'll go through and read your stuff. Already, it's a few hours of work picking up now. I'll see if I can get through it. I'll attribute. If you want to, you can have it attributed to you. It's a no skin if I knows. And you produce it so you can listen to it, do it. Now, the thing is that if you particularly don't want to do it, you can give it to a kid, your child, to do it. That was the cheapest Christmas present ever. Ask your child to do a few multiple choice questions and give them the present. I don't mind to do it. It's really opening up, and hopefully there'll be other areas. Of course, I'm very much focused on the strategic front where I want the X-Wings to fly to. I want them to fly to quantum mechanics, fly away from this industrial economy, mine coal at all costs. Look, Australia could save the planet single-handedly. It would crash our economy, but we'd just stop selling coal. If Australia stopped selling coal, it would send the prices sky high, send the world to invest like anything in coal mining. Oh, I don't know, it would be just chaotic. But that's what it really needs. Coal needs a bit of chaos mixed in to get stuff coal. Australia should ethically not sell coal. But so we to sell coal, we have to actually train our kids in a particular way that they keep on selling coal. That's the most important lesson, I think, that we're teaching our kids, that it's okay to sell coal. And I've got a different plan to go ahead. I don't know quite what it is, but I do know strategically, World War One drama, you know, World War One play is not where we want to go. We want to get going, and so that's it. And again, to the people nominated, I'll get round to you, and we'll get these things going. You don't have to do it instantly. It's all asynchronous. So this is, it's unlike the school stuff where everything has to happen on a date and everything has to go. It may sit for 3 weeks, a month, 3 months. One or two people get going and it can take off on its own steam and logic and be fundamentally more efficient. So thanks a lot as I finish this cardiac walk, and we'll see where this all lands us. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.